Welcome, welcome, guys. We're back for another episode of The Lock-In, sponsored by the lovely people over at WPT Global. I'm David Appin. I'm joined, as usual, by Dara O'Kearney, who, by the time the show airs, will be mid-air on his way to Las Vegas to play the World Series of Poker. Now, Dara, are you all packed yet? And secondarily, how many lucky shirts are in that suitcase?
Not fully packed yet. My wife told me my suitcase would be prepared this afternoon. I don't need to bring that many lucky shirts, thankfully, this time. First of all, I don't have that many lucky shirts. It hasn't really been that lucky of a year. But as you remember, David, which the place I stayed last year and you shared with me for some of it has its own laundromat. So I don't need to bring as much.
Yes, I remember that laundromat vividly because I remember doing your laundry after we pretended you did your laundry for the sake of the lock-in.
Yeah. I mean, we're just a pile of fakers in this show, really.
Well, look, any truth, Dara, to the rumor that you have a custom-made new shirt that you're going to deploy in Vegas?
I can neither confirm nor deny that at this point.
Well, Dara, you tweeted a few weeks ago that this was supposed to be a relaxing couple of weeks off ahead of your 5-week relentless stint in Vegas. The best laid plans of mice and men, huh?
Yeah, WPT Global picked a great week to sort of launch their new nightly schedule, which is an amazing schedule now. They have, you know, all the types of buy-ins and games that I would normally be playing. So I can do a very good grind. But even better, they've been doing this promotion where if a game overlays, and pretty much everything has been overlaying because, you know, the schedule is new, they drop tickets into your account for the next day, which presumably is to help reduce the overlays, but also, you know, reward the people who are helping them reduce the overlays. So that's kind of made it essential to play every night. So I've had to kind of go back cap in hand to my wife and tell her actually that week off I was going to take isn't happening now.
Indeed, indeed. Well, WPT is turning into the home of overlays these days. I've deployed bath picks and I will continue to do so until these guarantees start getting hit. Without further ado, the only way we could cope, the only way I could cope with my jealousy of Dara going to the World Series of Poker, because I'm starting to feel a little bit jealous, I'm going to be honest, is by grabbing somebody else for this episode who is also staying on this side of the pond. He is a great friend of the show. He is an Irish Poker Open champion, no less. He is the great and pretty damn good David Doherty. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me back on, guys. I can't believe that you're feeling FOMO for the WSOP. Come on, Lappin. You're better than that.
I don't know. I just... I got just a little bit... do you know what? We're going to talk about it a bit later on in the episode, but just the last few days, I suppose, the people who won events has made it sort of feel like the romance has been injected back into it. That will be kicked out of me pretty quickly. I'll be pretty happy to be elsewhere pretty soon, I'm sure. But it just felt like a smiley, happy couple of days. First up, David, how are you feeling? You had a tough old week last week in Namur. For once, it wasn't your opponents dealing out the bad beats.
Yeah, you're lucky this isn't a remembrance episode, really. I got hospitalised, for those who don't know. I bagged 100 big blinds on day one of the PokerStars Open, the Namur main event. And that day I'd started feeling a little bit of pain in my side, but it didn't really come to anything. The following day was a day off, and it did come to something that day, and I ended up going to hospital, where I was told that I had a 9mm kidney stone blocking my ureter, so I had to get an emergency procedure to unblock that. Otherwise, it could have turned very, very nasty indeed. But I get kept in hospital for 2 nights, which meant that my stack blinded out of the main event. So I was lying in my hospital bed in my hospital gown, sweating the bubble hard because it took like 40 minutes for the bubble to burst, and apparently I was one of the shorter stacks. But in the end, I made one pay jump, so... all that ICM study paid off in the end.
Well, look, I can actually sympathise with what you went through as a fellow stoner. I'm sure that won't be taken out of context to use against me at some future point. I know only too well what you went through with the stones, although I will say that you're dead right. Getting it caught in that way, if that hadn't been addressed properly, I think, you know, blood poisoning and things like that can be very nasty side effects and actually very life-threatening. So I'm glad they looked after you over there. On the bright side, you did manage to make that cash, though. I suppose a few ladders too from the hospital bed, is that right?
One ladder in the end, yeah. So I got the min cash secure. I think I had like 4 blinds after the bubble went or something, and then everyone went mental post-bubble, and I managed to get one pay jump. But yeah, it was still okay. Like, at least I got some rebate. I fired 3 bullets and got 2 back, so it's not too bad.
Not too bad. I know you're chasing the PokerStars Live leaderboard this year. How much do you estimate, actually, that may have hurt your chances? You obviously would have, you know, well, let's hope you would have gone deeper in the main, but you would have fired sides and all that kind of stuff as well. So you probably lost out on quite a few opportunities.
Yeah, the bigger concern for me wasn't even the main event, because I think the low leaderboard's going to be the more beneficial one to chase for securing top 10. And the Namur, aside from the Irish Open, the Namur was the most prosperous stop for the number of low events that were on the schedule. So I got a min cash in the cup, which was like, I think, a €400 buy-in right before the main. And then I played the main, and I was out of hospital before the end of the trip, but I was initially planning to go back and play, but I didn't realise just how ill I would feel afterwards. So even when I got back to the room, I crossed the road to go to the shop, and I was like in severe pain and out of breath and stuff. So there was just no real opportunity for me to go back and play anything. It means that I missed probably seven or eight small side events that I could have got points in, and I saw some of my challengers overtake me and some of them stretch their leads on me and so on. So I think it might have really damaged my chances of winning the low leaderboard, but I think I've still got a pretty good chance of getting top 10. I'm still seventh at the moment, so it's not too bad.
Very good, very good. David, obviously in a lot of pain there, as he described. I'm not sure that would have actually stopped you. I recall you being very, very sick indeed in Dusk Till Dawn about a decade or so ago, but you soldiering through. Without being too graphic, can you remind me what happened there?
Yeah, I don't think I was in the main event anymore. I think I was playing like the cup or whatever it was. It was a UK IPT stop, I think. And it sort of got late in the day, and suddenly I started to feel really, really, really bad, like just as bad as I've ever felt. So I went to the bathroom, and yeah, you said not to be too graphic. So let's just say that when the body is very, very sick, it tends to try and expel whatever is making it sick to two different places, and they were both being full effect. So I spent the last hour of the tournament pretty much in the bathroom, and then I came out, had like 10 minutes, had to go all in, lost. And then I was so worried about that there might be an accident in the cab on the way home that I decided I was going to actually walk home, which, you know, in the state I was in, was a very, very poor decision indeed. So by the time I got back to central Nottingham, I was in a horrendous state. I just got sort of like collapsed into bed. I have very little memory of the next 36 hours, except I was in bed and I was sick. And every so often, your wonderful partner, Sharon, was coming to make sure I was still alive, give me water, et cetera, et cetera. So I soldiered through those 36 hours. As this is happening, our friend and friend of the show and former graphic designer of the show, Willie Elliott, was actually going onto the final table of the biggest ever UK IPT Nottingham. And he was massive chip leader. And we were asked to go in and do commentary. I was still so sick, I think, that we actually delayed our arrival until I at least felt somewhat better. And unfortunately, we arrived just as he was literally punting off and busting, which created a little bit of a...
Just as he was bluffing into ace, quad aces.
Quads, yeah. He was repping quads into quads. So he... It created a bit of a continuity error, because I went in to do the commentary then, and I obviously knew what was coming. So Nick Welthall, who I was doing the commentary with, was like, oh, this is going great for Willie, and I already know that Willie has bust, so I have to kind of put a brave face on it. And then when the hand comes up, I obviously have to pretend I don't know what's going to happen. But then in the middle of the hand, I literally just appear in shot, looking after the dumbfounded on the rail. Like, what have you done, Willie?
And you did. I remember the expression was sort of like you looking at the board going, what the fuck is this? Anyway, we'll move off this topic before Dara talks about his bowels again. Let's move actually to the decision, I suppose, not to play the World Series. I've made it, and Dave, you like me, have decided not to go this year. I have to say that I thought of you when I read an excellent tweet by Blaise Bourgeois a few days ago, which I suppose encapsulates not just this year, although it has some specifics about this year, but actually just kind of one of the just generalized issues with the World Series. He said, the WSOP took in 42.2 million in rake last year. They increased rake virtually across the board in 2025. WSOP Plus, that app, has been a great addition, but PokerStars Live has been around since 2022 and is much, much better. Other than that, worse product, worse player experience, higher rake. If we're going to pay obscene rake, we should expect the best dealers, some casino security at the door, online events to run smoothly with rapid solutions to any hiccups, consistency across the board, better promotions, off-felt activities for players on site. To this, former guest of the show, Katie Stone, replied, "Those are all great things, but they all have one thing in common. They benefit the player. This particular company has shown for a long time now that it is not their concern. There is no amount of money and rake that can be paid that will miraculously change the culture of this company. The decision has to be intentional and has to come from the top down." So, David, your thoughts on what Blaise and Katie said there?
Yeah, I mean, the WSOP for a long time, in my eyes, has not been a must-play series. I know that some people consider bracelets very prestigious and have reasons for chasing them. I just prefer my tournaments to be well-run and well-structured. And also, I don't like the baking heat in Vegas in the summer. I'd much prefer it off-season in October or November or whatever. But in terms of like my decision to play there and the relevance to that tweet, I think the dealer issue is always one that comes up. Now, I do have a smidgen of sympathy here for the WSOP, because I do think in terms of scale, it's very, very difficult to expect the best dealers across the board. Like in comparison to Stars Live events, for example, I think the biggest EPT ever had like 2,200 runners around about there, whereas the WSOP main event last year had over 10,000 runners. So in terms of scale, it's really difficult to get that quality of dealer, especially when you go to Vegas and the Wynn and the Venetian and the Aria are employing the best dealers, and Caesars, for want of a better phrase, are picking up the scraps. There are some very good dealers at the WSOP, but they're few and far between. And I've had some absolute nightmares over the years where people weren't even aware of what the correct actions were. For example, I saw someone open to 10x in a pot limit Omaha event, and the dealer just let it slide. So these are the kind of things that you're having to deal with. I do, as I say, I do have a smidgen of sympathy with them in that regard. They're trying to run a World Series. The scale of it is astronomical. It's very, very difficult to control the standard of dealer if you're going to put that many tournaments on. However, there is a very clear argument there in terms of the rate that they're generating, that the player experience could be much better. I do think it's improved since they moved from the Rio to the Horseshoe and Paris. But in terms of off-felt activities, if you do compare this to an EPT, there's absolutely nothing in Vegas. They're not giving out, and you're in Las Vegas of all places. There's plenty of opportunity there to give the players a little rate back. There's no tickets to shows. There's no excursions. There's no there's nothing put on in the venue in terms of a player's party for the main event or anything like that. I think the WSOP are quite content to allow the prestige of the brand, if you like, to be the sole experience that players get to enjoy. If someone from the States is attending the WSOP for the first time, they're excited just to be playing one of their events. And if they've never been to Europe, they're not aware of how, spectacular these events can be run. Even at the NEPT last year, I know you went there as well, David. I think that was clearly better run than the WSOP when it was a Stars event in Vegas. But a lot of the American players, while I was at that NEPT, commented just how happy they were with it and how well run an event it was. And from my perspective, it was a good event, but it was nothing on EPTs. Like the American staff were running it. The European staff were over there, giving them advice, being there for support and whatnot, but they weren't actually running it. And I think you can see, if you've ever played EPT Barcelona, EPT Prague, and I want to include the WPT in this as well. I haven't played the event at the Wynn at the end of the year, but I think when you look at how these events are run, the Wynn 10K at the end of the year, all the major EPTs, and compare it to the WSOP, the scaling is a reasonable argument, but beyond that, they just fall apart everywhere else, I think.
Yeah, I think like all excellent points and well articulated. I think what stands out to me there is your point about how they just kind of trade off the legacy of that like brand. It's a 50-year-old brand. It's the thing we all watched on TV probably when we started watching poker for the first time. and they just know that they can squeeze everybody. It's not a nice experience. And I said on the last lock-in, actually, when Joanne was on, that for me, the prestige of something comes from how the players are treated. And I couldn't agree more. I think EPTs and WPTs are just the best run events you'll find. And therefore, I feel like they're more important, and I would rather win one of those than a World Series bracelet. But removing, of course, the main event, which would be life-changing, of course. Darren, to pick up on one thing in particular here, one of Blaise's points, he said, online events to run smoothly with rapid solutions to any hiccups. Now, that's a not so thinly veiled reference to the colossal fuck up when the mystery bounty event, the 250 mystery bounty, shat the bed last week. For example, days later, and I know this has been resolved somewhat in the last couple of days, but days later, friend of the show, Jamie Kerstetter, for example, didn't know if she was actually going to get the 16K bounty that she ripped from a non-sitting out player, from a player who was active, and, you know, because only about maybe half the people in the tournament were disconnected and the other half played on. And obviously, if you play on, you think, well, everything that happens here could be a value. To be fair to the WSOP, it does seem like they're making people mostly whole now, but it took days, and it was a really sort of obvious opportunity for them to do some good customer service, the way online sites do when they have a collapse of their network or a GDPR, or sorry, not GDPR, DDoS attack. Or anything like that. They all have these kind of inbuilt solutions that sort of assure players, look, give us 24 hours and then we'll have you all sorted. And it took days and days.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel some amount of sympathy for them because, you know, WSOP.com is a very small site, 11 months of the year or 10 months of the year. You know, they're not really used to dealing with the sort of volume of players that suddenly is going to descend on the place for the WSOP. That said, I mean, they know it's coming, so they should kind of prepare for it. I think, you know, we've all seen sites that have difficulties. That's just an unfortunate fact of online poker. These difficulties arise. What's really important is that you just have very clear policies in place so that you can immediately point people to sort of like, well, this is what's going to happen, which seems to have been missing here. It wasn't exactly clear how they were going to deal with it. They should really have anticipated that this was a very, very likely outcome of running sort of tournaments that are 100 times bigger in terms of runners than what they're used to dealing with, and therefore had not just a plan in place for how they were going to respond to it, but actually like what the rules would be, work out in advance. Like, are we going to give everybody their money back? Are we doing some sort of ICM chop? Are we putting on an extra promotion? You know, all the things that sites typically do when there's an outage.
Yeah, well said, well said. Well, moving on now to the story of the first week, which Barry and I briefly covered actually on the news segment on our first WPT Global sponsored show last week. Speaking of which, sign up now to WPT Global today using bonus code CHIPRACE. Not only will you get a welcome bonus up to $3,000, not only will you get to enjoy those aforementioned overlays that Dara spoke of, but most importantly, you'll keep this show on the air. Don't be shy now. Excellent. Thank you very much to the person who just signed up there. Dara, we can keep this show going now. Again, this is the way this works now. We are literally the living jukebox.
Yeah, I just, you know, this is what I dreamed of all my life as I come into my seventh decade, being a jukebox.
Well, next up, Benny Glaser's two bracelets. That's the story I was talking about. Benny won his sixth and seventh bracelet in just 4 days last week and is putting down a marker as one of the players most likely to hunt down Helmuth for most WSOP bracelets ever. The reason Benny is probably a very good bet in this regard is his age, his commitment to the game, and his prowess in all the games. As far as I know, he has 25 or 30 coupes, a stat which clearly shows his pedigree. David, you know me. Is he the man to catch Helmuth, and will he do it before 2050?
I think so, before 2050. Yeah, I mean, if Benny has the commitment, and I'm saying that Tony G here, the heart and commitment to catch Phil, if that's something that matters to him, I think he certainly will catch him. I have to admit, I'm a little bit pissed at Benny for winning two bracelets because I had him in my poker.org fantasy team and then took him out at the last minute because I couldn't fit everyone else in around him because he was so expensive. Now I understand why he was so expensive. So apologies, Benny, for dropping you. Congrats on the two bracelets. But yeah, I do think he's a decent bet. Anyone who plays these mixed game events, the smaller fields, 10Ks or whatever, he's going to be one of the best players in the field. A lot of these older guys who have the bracelet records, I think Helmuth is still capable of winning another couple over the next few years. But the likes of Nagranu and Matisau, who I think still believe they're among the best in the field, are just drawing dead against a lot of the younger guys. A lot of even unknown European players who are coming up now and will be playing these events in coming years. So, yeah, I think Benny, there's someone else who won seven bracelets this week who could be, a shout in the coming years. But I think they've got eight to catch Helmuth, right? They're still not even halfway there yet, so it's still a ways to go.
Yeah, no, it is a ways to go. And, even as you said there, with the 10Ks having smaller fields and him being, maybe top five player in those fields, probably not in every game, but probably in some of the games he might even be the best. You do feel like he's the kind of guy who could rip off a bracelet once every 2 years or maybe occasionally two in a week. Darren, turning to you last Wednesday, Darren Elias and Nick Schulman duked it out for the Deuce to Seven Lowball Championship bracelet, with the latter coming out on top after a truly epic 8 hour heads up battle. That's obviously what Dave was referring to as the other seven bracelet man, joining the same club as Benny, a club which actually includes Billy Baxter, John Hennigan, Menwin, Daniel Negreanu, and Scott Seaver. Of that group, only Scott Seaver is the other somewhat younger person, and Scott is, 40 as well. So I think maybe it's Scott and Shulman are 40, and Benny's in his 30s, and the rest of them are old farts. Your thoughts on Shulman's almost low-key march to greatness? Because I think it is almost like, even though he's a really visible public guy, he does the World Series main event commentary with Ali, and we all love him for that. He's an amazing cash game player. He's been one of the top players for years, and he just sort of, quietly goes about his business and has accumulated seven bracelets almost under the radar.
I mean, I guess there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, he's obviously a very low-key character. He's not the kind of guy who's going to be like making a huge splash on social media about it. I also think maybe he's sort of like people just kind of think of, oh, he's that commentator guy, and they kind of forget about how just how good he is at poker, and how accomplished he is on that front. I was watching WPT Global streamer Sven McDermott the other night, and Sven was talking about all the content creators currently playing in the WPT Global streets, and he was saying it's great because typically content creators are not as good at poker as the other regs. And there is certainly that perception that, like, if you do other stuff, if you're a vlogger or you do commentary or something, then maybe you're not at the peak anymore. But that's definitely not the case with Nick. Like, Nick is at the absolute pinnacle.
Yeah, I think what's interesting for him is, and he said it in his post-match interview, and it was a great interview, worth checking out if you haven't seen it. He talks about family life. He has a daughter now, and just how that has sort of made tournaments a bit more suitable. These late night cash games don't really fit with the dad life. He wants to be around for his daughter and his family. So sort of just being able to schedule time to go play tournaments, knowing that's work time, and then the other time is not work time, as opposed to the, I guess, slightly more degen, when a good game appears, you just have to play all hours kind of lifestyle. But he is one of those guys who came from that upbringing. We've interviewed him on the show. Obviously, was a prodigy in his youth, and played pool at a really high level. Commentates on pool too, and sort of lived that sort of hustler life, if you like, at a very young age. And just has all the chops, basically just all the street sense and chops you need. Any thoughts there, Dave, on Nick Schulman and his sort of rise to seven bracelets?
I just want to highlight one thing that I saw in the poker news updates of his win as well, where he pulled a huge bluff on the river on Martin Cabrel and then dropped an all-timer quote on him. He channeled his inner Heisenberg and said, "Say my name, Martin," as he windmilled the bluff across the table to him. So yeah, like, he probably deserved an extra bracelet just for that. Everyone likes to get it up Martin Cabrel, I think. So yeah, he's a legend of the game, as you say. I think very understated. I honestly was quite surprised myself to see that he had seven bracelets after that. I wasn't aware that he was that high up the rankings, but yeah, I mean, his commentary transformed that medium. I think he just brought a whole new angle to a whole new level of analysis that challenged everyone else to raise their games, I think. So he seems like one of the good guys. Yeah, I'm pretty happy for him to have, joined that elite club.
Yeah, pick up on one small thing about the commentary. We've talked about how great his game is, but I suppose being that good a player, sitting in the booth at a Triton at the World Series, on high stakes poker and whatever it is, it never feels like he's patronizing. It never feels like he's a know-it-all. In fact, quite the opposite. Even though he is the guy who probably knows all the spots maybe better than almost anyone, he always sort of goes on the which is a really good thing, the commentator's journey with the player, and has real respect for the players in the arena. And if they're going, you know, with exploitative lines, let's say, or fishy lines, he will be generous in his coverage of that, and sort of just ultimately shows respect for people who put skin in the game. And I think that's just, as you say, just takes his commentary to another level. In other bracelet news, also last Wednesday, which really was a red letter day for the World Series, this is why I'm getting all, you know, soppy and doe-eyed about wanting to be there. Jason Kuhn won his second bracelet in the 50K, defeating Andrew "Lucky Chewy" Lichtenberger heads up on a final table that included his best friend Ben Tollerine, Victor Blom, and Brock Wilson. It was a fairly savage, like, last five or six. Like, it was really, you know, who was going to win that was going to really have to earn it. We spoke to Jason a few months ago on the show, and he seemed to be in a very good place in life this past month or so. He's won two Tritons and now this bracelet. Are we looking at next year's Hall of Fame inductee, Dara?
We could very well be. I mean, we're massive fans of Jason here on the show, obviously, because well, he's a friend of ours. He's been very generous coming on the show different times, not just to do interviews but also strategy content. I mean, Jason's an absolute beast. Like, you look at his record, for example, in Tritons, it's absolutely phenomenal. He's somebody who's been around as well, sort of like over the entire course of our career, and he's had quite the arc from sort of like the angry young man that started to the respected older family man now, or middle-aged family man, whatever you want to call him. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Jason, you can't really overpraise Jason.
Indeed. Well, Dave, your thoughts on how important, I suppose, all that other stuff is. You know, we mentioned how Jason was sort of in a very good place in his life, you know, family, kids, routine, I suppose, is what came across a lot in that, and good mental game, which, you know, he's obviously had for a long time. How important do you rate those sorts of off the felt things for, you know, how effective it makes you feel on the felt?
Yeah, I mean, Dara alluded to it there. Like, I'm old enough as well to remember Jason rising through the ranks. And when I was subscribed to, I think it was Run at Once, he made videos for. I remember him doing lots of mental game and even just health related videos. So I remember watching a video where he just went over his diet on Run at Once. So that's not the kind of thing you expect to sign up, you expect to watch when you sign up for a poker training site. But yeah, I do think it's overlooked by a lot of pros these days, even still. Like, I mean, I'm even talking about my episode in the Moor where I wanted to play again after I came out of the hospital and did make a conscious decision not to. I think ultimately I could have played if I wanted to, but I think I made the better decision for my health reasons. Obviously, most decisions for people aren't as niche as that. But I do think it's vital to be in a good mental state when you enter the game, and you can't control. There's a lot of stuff in your life that you can't control, right? You need to be able to forget those things, maybe not forget them, but just set them aside for the time that you're playing, and learn to understand what you can and can't control at the table. I think Jason's very, very good at that, and work very hard at the things that you can control. Now, some of those things might be your reactions to losing a particular pot. Maybe you have, you know, the chip lead and you lose 80% of your stack, and now you have to grind 20 big blinds instead of, you know, putting pressure on everyone. A lot of people have difficulty adjusting to that in game. Like, even just a different mindset of, you know, I don't want to be playing these 20 blinds. I want to have 80 blinds again. And that's just one example. But there's so many issues like that that I think are still very overlooked. Like, everyone's absolutely obsessed these days. I mean, rightly in some sense, but obsessed with studying GTO charts and making sure that they're playing, you know, correctly in every single spot. But you can't even do that unless your mind's in the game, right? You can't find your best possible self unless you're prepared to sit these long hours and try and find your A game on a consistent basis, or a strong B game as the case may be. But yeah, Jason's always been a huge advocate of that. As I say, I think I learned a lot from watching his training videos over the years. So yeah, he's another one that I'm really happy to see have the success that he's having.
Yeah, definitely one of the goats. I hinted at it there. Jason turns 40 this year, I believe, so not eligible for Hall of Fame consideration this year. But I do want to talk about the Hall of Fame. It's a prestigious institution, I guess, established in 1979. It honors the legends of poker who've made indelible marks on the game. iconic players, influential industry figures, a random whist player or bridge player from the 1800s. The Hall of Fame celebrates those who have demonstrated skill, integrity, and longevity in the world of poker, no doubt, with only one person inducted these days. It's a very exclusive club. It's actually becoming more exclusive because I think people are passing away at a greater rate than one a year. A lot has been made of the induction process and how it needs to be changed. Aaron and I have actually voiced this in previous shows and probably last year and the year before when it was like this. David, what do you think? Our vote would be sort of like maybe, and I'm sorry, I don't want to speak for you here, Dara, but I think we were fairly consistent on this, that it would be like two get in each year and maybe every second or third year a builder, a kind of a Matt Savage, Isai Scheinberg type person also gets considered.
You're asking me there, David, yeah?
Yes, yeah, Dave. Yeah, no, sorry. Darren and
Yeah.
I probably talked about this ad nauseum
Yeah,
in the
yeah.
past, so we'd like to get your take.
I mean, I just I think the exclusivity of the Hall of Fame is a problem because if your credentials in the poker world are on par with someone else who's already in the Hall of Fame, why should a yearly limit affect you getting in? Like you I understand the age limit because you need longevity in the game, but if you've achieved that longevity at the age of eligibility, why can't you just get in with three other people at the same time? I don't really understand the need for like this, exclusivity part of it. And I remember I'm not too in tune with a lot of people who are up for the Player of the Year votes or anything, but I do remember the year that Devilfish was campaigning to get in just before he passed away. And I remember there being a little bit of bite back from the Americans because it was a very American-centric vote, and it generally is. I feel like personally, if you got a panel of Europeans and held a vote for the Poker Hall of Fame, they would come up with very different candidates than the Americans would. So it's not just a matter of exclusivity, it's a matter of the voting panel and whether they're producing candidates who fit their own ideals or whether they're producing candidates who fit poker ideals. So I feel like it's the former. So I generally don't pay too much attention to it. I don't think I'll ever achieve anything significant enough to be inducted in it, so it doesn't really concern me in that regard. But yeah, I feel like I don't really understand why there's this exclusivity to it. Yeah, they have the Ballon d'Or every year in football. That makes sense because footballers have a finite time to make their impact. Poker players can play their whole life. So like, I just don't understand why there has to be this limit to it. But I do agree with the idea of adding more people to it rather than just one per year.
Yeah, I feel like you're drawing me back in, and actually, I maybe we will talk about it for just a minute or two, and I'll throw to you, Dara, as well. I think one obvious solution would be make it older. Like 50 seems like a decent age to start considering lifetime achievement-y type stuff that the Hall of Fame would recognize. So 40 maybe is too young, and that might at least postpone the problem for a while, or at least make people have to survive the test of time for another decade. For their overall consideration, I think that's definitely an option. I think you're right. Bringing two or three people in each year would seem pretty reasonable as well. And I totally agree. And that's why I actually want to bring it back up and throw to you, Dara. David made the point about European consideration. I do always feel like the Hall of Fame, when this comes around every year, it's basically like they just go, Bobby's room and how many bracelets do you have? And fucking nothing else matters, really.
Yeah, I mean, and it is an American institution, and all institutions tend to have some sort of local bias, but it does seem particularly so in the case of the Hall of Fame. And that's kind of the way it is. Now, to be fair, like America is still a massive part of world poker in live poker terms. American, it's probably America versus the rest, but in Hall of Fame, it's definitely not even 50-50. So that's one thing. And you mentioned like as well that people are probably dying faster now than people are getting in. So obviously they're worried about devaluing it too much, similar to the bracelet and having hundreds and hundreds of them. So maybe when somebody passes away, that could open up an extra spot that year as well. That's one possibility.
Interesting, interesting. Well, look, last year Patrick Antonius did book the trend actually as a European who was chosen. Right now we're in that public nomination period. On June 17th, the finalists will be announced, and then on July 11th, the inductee will be revealed ahead of Event 92, the Hall of Fame bounty. How's about a little game now? I'm going to say a name of a person. You're both going to take turns. Dara, maybe go first, and then David, you answer right after. I'll say a name, and you tell me this year. Someday, never. Okay. Dara, first person, perennial nominee, Matt Savage.
I love you, Matt, but I'm going to say never.
Oh, Matt's going to just be on the nomination list for eternity. There's a certain sort of I don't know, like waiting room hellish sort of thing. I think he's been nominated like 9 times or on the nomination shortlist 9 or 10 times now. But yeah, you might be right. Unless they kind of switched their mindsets around the builder thing, I think you could be right. Well, what do you think, Dave?
I would have said someday, to be honest, but again, that maybe that's me thinking more in terms of they will have to change the rules at some point. I think not to hog the limelight here, but I do think that one other thing that I didn't mention there is that it isn't being considered properly in this induction process is that poker, when the Hall of Fame started, was a much smaller game globally. You know, in terms of the people that were playing it, there might have been a couple of hundred that would have ever even have been eligible full time over the course of their lifetime. Nowadays, when you include online poker, like, is someone like Nicholas Astett going to be in it in future? He certainly should be, but like, is he ever going to be considered for it? Because if he isn't, then we need to look at what, you know, the Poker Hall of Fame actually constitutes. Like, the game itself is magnitudes bigger than it ever was when the Poker Hall of Fame was created. So I think you need a lot more spots. And that would be why someone like Matt would be a given for me, not this year, but in future, but on the basis that they add more spots.
Great points, great points. British poker legend Barney Boatman, or let's say collectively the original Hendon Mob crew. Dara?
I mean, Barney should definitely get in, for sure.
Dave?
I'll give the same answer that Dara gave in the last one. I love you, Barney, but I think you'll never get in because you're European.
Ah, okay. Miami John Cernuto, Dara. I think he might be up there with the favorites this year if they can somehow book the trend of the new ballots people getting in.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is this year or never, right?
Probably.
I hope it's this year. I mean, genuine legend.
Yeah. Dave.
I'll say never again. I think it's getting a little bit too congested for him.
Nick Schulman, Dara.
Someday for sure.
Someday. Dave?
Someday as well. Yeah, that's an easy one.
Scott Seaver?
Someday.
And someday as well.
Norman Chad and Lon McCarron.
Again, I love the two guys, but I can't see them ever getting in.
Yeah, well, Negrano's still got a vote. They're not getting in.
Josh Arrier.
Ooh, that's a genuinely tough one. Josh is one of these guys who like kind of just flies under the radar quite a lot. I mean, I'm probably going to say never, realistically.
Yeah, I think that one's tough as well. But on the basis that he still has a few years to rack up some more results, I'm going to go with the someday. Not based on what he's currently achieved, but I think he might achieve enough to get in the future.
Mike Matisseau.
I think Mike's ship has sailed, so I'm going to say never.
Someday, I think that even though he's passed it in the current day's terms, he probably deserves to get in overall for his impact during the boom, even though I'm not a huge fan of Mike these days. But yeah, I think he'll get in eventually.
Fair enough. Kathy Lieber.
I definitely think Kathy should be in there, just in terms of longevity as a female. There have been other females who maybe shone more brightly for a while, but Kathy has just been around for so long. But yeah, I'm going to say someday, but it's a kind of an optimistic someday.
And I'm going to say never, even though I agree that she should be in. But again, this harks back to my point that there's just not enough room to include all the people that should be in there if you're only adding one a year.
Fair enough. Ted Forrest.
I think he does. David keeps reminding us how congested it is, and I think Ted is going to suffer from that congestion. So never.
Yeah, agreed. If he had got in maybe 10 years ago, or well, if he was on the list 10 years ago, is what I should say, he had a better chance then than he ever will going forward now. So the fact that he's not in at the moment, I will say never.
Okay, and quick fire on the last six here. So let's go bang, bang, bang. Isai Scheinberg, Dara.
Again, he should be, but I'm going to say never.
Same answer.
Michael Mizrahi.
Someday.
Someday.
Antonio Esfandiari.
Someday.
Someday.
Hookseed.
Someday.
Never.
Gus Hansen.
This is tough, particularly in the light fire round. I'm going to say someday.
Never.
Chris Ferguson.
Never.
Yeah, never.
Well, that's enough of that. Let's chat very finally, last topic about the PokerStars event in Malaga, which David and I are going to because we're not going to Vegas. It's on next week. This was a pretty cool event, it's got to be said, last year. Bigger than expected, hampered slightly by the casino's own processes, but Stars have assured us that there will be they'll be all over all aspects of the organization this time round. And to be fair with Stars, and we've said it before on the show, they're very good at nailing events the second time out. They're quick to recognize what could be done better, and actually a lot of credit goes to both their customer feedback system, which is always very open, and people like Chip Race, alumni previously mentioned on this episode, Willie Elliott, who are very responsive to player needs. David, let's pretend you win the PokerStars Live leaderboard and then they make you an ambassador, which, by the way, long overdue. They should have made you an ambassador by now. Shame on them. Tell us a bit about how people like Willie are worth their weight in gold, bearing in mind that I say that now, aware that he's a skinny cunt these days.
Jesus. Well, I'm glad I hope he gets to watch this. This will be good. I mean, I'm obviously going to be very biased. I've known Willie for a long time, like you guys as well, but I've written in reviews of their live stops in the past, and I think he's the beating heart of the live tour. Like, I think all the players love him. I think the work that he does behind the scenes is often underappreciated or unknown, what goes on, but he's always there to help. And it wasn't in Namur, but I want to give a shout out to Gergana, who was in there in his stead in Namur, who actually came to visit me in the hospital. That's the kind of level of commitment that you're getting from PokerStars staff and player care. Just not just Willie. I don't want to I love Willie to bits, but like I don't want to just isolate him because the whole every member of staff there is fantastic at what they do.
Well said, well said. Dara, very quickly on the same topic, sort of, how overdue is Dave Doherty being made a PokerStars ambassador? And since we know David Curtis very well, I suppose this is a really nice opportunity to tell him to get his finger out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, I thought Dave already was a PokerStars ambassador. That's how overdue it is. I mean, he's done everything. He's an OG on the UK IPT circuit. He won the Player of the Year. He won the Irish Open, which was technically a UK IPT. He's incredibly popular with ordinary players. Always very approachable. Yeah, no, it's just a perfect ambassador in my book.
Yeah, sorted out, Stars. Speaking of upcoming live events, there are three WPT events on the horizon. On the 11th of July, there's a WPT Venetian in Las Vegas. That's a 5K with a 4 million guarantee. Dara, you might play that one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this year I am actually looking around, not just to necessarily play all the WSOP. I've always in the past taken the view of that I'm just there to play the WSOP, but that view has gradually been maybe not beaten out of me, but queued out of me as I join longer long queues. That said, I mean, obviously, apparently the app has solved the thing, so I'm not sure how my exact schedule will look this year, but certainly I won't necessarily purely be thinking in terms of WSOP.
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, from July 23rd to 27th in Dublin's Green Isle Hotel, the Irish Poker Tour will be collaborating with the WPT Global Team for the Summer in Dublin Poker Extravaganza. For that one, there are 30 free roll satellites to the $300 main event over the course of the next month, starting about now, actually. And if you win your ticket via one of those free rolls and win the tournament, you will get an extra 100K from WPT Global. Not too shabby there. Dara, how do you think that one's going to go down with the Irish public?
I mean, that's an amazing promotion when you think about it. And it could create an incredible scenes at the final table
Yeah.
where one or two of the players can actually win that extra 100K, and they're then playing a totally different tournament from everyone else. Just before we came on air for this, I actually recorded a strategy short with Barry Carter for Simplified Poker on what the differences in strategy would be whether you were in the free roll or not. It's an incredible promotion because, you know, that 100K would be bigger than first prize, I imagine. So, you know, there could be some people who are playing for 180K, let's say, and second prize is 30K. So it's
Yeah.
going to create a very interesting situation on the final table in terms of like normal final table ICM.
It sure will. Well, finally, there is a 2 million guarantee WPT Cyprus in mid-August, for which there will also be free roll satellites. For this one, I know the only condition is you have to have deposited a tenner on the site. These just started and will go on Sundays, every Sunday from now till August 3rd. And yes, again, WPT will pay an extra 100 grand if you win the tournament, having got in via one of those free roll satellites. David, just as a final thought from you, what do you make of these? Obviously, it's almost like a miniature version. I hope the team won't mind me saying that, of what the Gold Rush thing is in Vegas at the moment, with this extra million being thrown on by the club WPT Gold team onto these WSOP events. What do you make of sort of the impact of this stuff?
It reminds me a little bit of the Soul Survivor promotion that they used to have at the Irish Open as well. I think Ian Simpson actually won the Irish Open the year that he was a Soul Survivor, so he got a little bit more money on top of that as well. It's just something to give back to the players, isn't it? It creates a little bit more buzz. It creates the opportunity for a legendary story. But yeah, overall, it's a recognition from the company that the players deserve something back, and they're giving it back in EV. Obviously, they're not going to give away 100K every single time, but it creates these weird dynamics, like Dara says, where you maybe got 16 players left in the tournament. There's two people still going for the 100K. It gets eyes on the tournament because you're trying to see whether these guys can go all the way from the free roll to win it, right? So, yeah, it's a great idea. I think it should happen more often.
Yeah, very clever indeed. It remains for me to thank our guest this week, David Doherty. Really appreciate you as usual.
Thanks, guys. I'm just going to go to the bathroom now. I've been holding in for over an hour now.
Oh dear, oh dear. And Dara, thank you so much.
Thank you, Dave. Just one clarification on something Dave said there. He said that Ian Simpson won the Soul Survivor and got lots of extra money as a result. I think he actually got it all in buy-ins and he didn't cash any of those tournaments. So, yeah.
Sorry, Ian.
It's just nice to know that the WPT Global version of the show will also relentlessly take the piss out of me, and I'm very happy about that. Good night, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on, guys. See you.